So my name is Hamza, and I would like to start by thanking the Mosaic Rooms for inviting me today. And I'm really delighted that the Mosaic Rooms are showing an exhibition of Algerian artists. And I think it's this kind of exhibitions and cultural exchange is an opportunity to discover other cultures and increase mutual understanding. It's just a shame that this kind of events do not happen often in Algeria, and they are not really given the importance they deserve. Because the Algerian authorities, of course, chose to invest money in a culture that is, reduced to its folkloric dimension, a culture that is sterile and not critical, and disconnected from the realities of Algerians' daily lives. And so I'm really happy that this exhibition is taking place today. I've been asked to give a little bit of a context of the political situation in Algeria. I think there is so much to say, so I'll try to be brief and give a few pointers so we can have maybe a good discussion afterwards. But let me say this first. No country is really disconnected from the international framework of neoliberal globalization and imperialist domination. No country, especially those in the global south, are spared from the profoundly unjust global order that generates exclusion, instability, poverty, wars, and uprisings. And I believe that it is within this context that we should analyze the recent events in the Middle East and North Africa. So we've seen 3 years ago how waves of uprisings swept away dictators one after the other. First, Zine El Abidine in Tunisia, then Mubarak in Egypt, and the list seemed that it's going to be bound to go on and on and on and on. And I think one thing that we should know, we should realize that these events are really unforgettable historical experience, and it inspired so many people in the world. And we've seen even occupiers from London to Wall Street were proud to walk like an Egyptian. So people in this region did not just revolt against authoritarianism or simply to demand democracy. I think they rose mainly against the oppressive socio-economic conditions under which they lived for decades. And these conditions are present in Algeria too. So we have unequal development, high unemployment, poverty, endemic corruption, nepotism. We have a frustrated, educated youth without horizons, and also parasitic bourgeoisies that continue to live in their countries like tourists. Of course, all of this didn't matter to the Western capitals when they gave their support to the dictators in place. We've been told that these dictators were an effective barrier to radical Islamism. We've seen how international institutions that represent the powerful and rich 1% praising the Egyptian and Tunisian economy for their wonderful achievements. But the truth is that these dictators in the region were submissive to Western interests and accepted to be dominated, and allowed transnational companies and the local bourgeoisies to continue the protected robbery, the exploitation, and the self-enrichment. So these events debunked many myths and shattered a lot of racial stereotypes about the people in the region. So we've heard by so many that Muslims and Arabs are not fit for democracy, or the people in the regions are passive. So, and we've seen how the waves of uprising spread from country to the other, from Tunisia to Egypt to Libya to Syria, Bahrain, Yemen, Oman, Jordan, and a lot of people were asking the question, what's happening with Algeria? We've read many articles in the Western media saying Algeria is being the exception, it's being at the margin of the Arab uprisings. But I don't think this is entirely true. Because if we look at what was happening in 2000 and 2010 and 2011, and the country saw an unprecedented number of demonstrations, strikes, occupations and clashes with the police. Just in 2010, the authorities, I think, registered around 10,500 such incidents. And at the same time of the Tunisian uprisings, in January 2011, there were many violent protests in several cities that led to many deaths. Of course, we didn't hear about this because Algeria was not at the center of the media spotlight. And of course, these were contained by a bloated police force. And many people were ironic about the situation then when they said that Algiers the white became Algiers the blue, in reference to the color of the uniform of the policeman. I think a lot of people, when they saw the rapidity with which the flames of revolt has spread in the region, they thought that change will come overnight and all the regimes in the region will fall one after the other like a house of cards. Of course, this did not happen. So if we come back to Algeria, for me, rather than seeing it as an exception, I see it as a precursor, because it had a short democratic transition after many, many violent protests in October 1988, when the regime was forced to open up for political pluralism and allow a relatively independent press. But of course, these were, the democratic transition was aborted by the military coup and the traumatic civil war that followed. To be honest, I don't like the use of civil war because there is nothing civil about it. It was a war against civilians, systematic violence from both sides, from the state and from the radical Islamists. And this war, in a way, traumatized the nations and left it less disposed to rise against an authoritarian regime that triumphed over radical Islamism at the expense of more than 100,000 deaths and thousands of disappearances. And again, this war divided the Democrats and left a political vacuum in face of the ruling political parties. There is almost no opposition that could mobilize the masses and take their demands forward. And if we see what happened in the last 3 years in the Arab region, that specter of the civil war and the fear of the bloody violence was exacerbated by the intervention in Libya and the chaos we still see there today, the counter-revolution in Egypt, and also the carnage and the foreign interferences in Syria. But beyond the civil war, maybe there is something we need to bear in mind. It's the nature of the Algerian despotism. Despotism in Algeria is collegial. It is shared and not concentrated on one person or one family that could focalize the hatred and the grudges. It is a kind of a diffuse dictatorship, and it is harder to dislodge than those that have a precise target, for popular resentment, like the one in Tunisia, for example, when Ben Ali was ruling. So these revolts. Let's just focus on Algeria. So let's not go to just the Arab Spring. So again, when talking about the collegial nature of the Algerian regime, we need to bear in mind the existence of the oligarchic coalitions and the complex clientelist networks that share the oil and gas rent. And this is a very important factor, because for me, the oil and gas rent plays two roles, one internal and one external. So the internal one is to pacify the local population and delay the radicalization of the popular anger, and of course to pay for a ubiquitous security force to contain any uprising. The external role is to buy Western approval and collusion. Algeria is the third provider of natural gas to the European Union after Russia and Norway. And with the dwindling gas production in the North Sea and the situation currently in Ukraine and the conflict between the West and Russia, Algeria could play an even more important role. And this role is combined with its involvement in the war against terror, another pretext for the West to expand militarily and to scramble for more resources. I think, despite all of this, I remain optimistic and positive that maybe that us, as the young generation, can bring about change. For me, the alternative is democracy. But what kind of democracy we're talking about? That's a very important question. Is it the democracy where we give more power to transnationals and abide by the dictates of the global markets? Is it a democracy where our rulers serve foreign interests and accept to be dominated? The answer for me is an obvious no. If we're talking about democracy, which is the sovereignty of the people, it cannot be constructed without being in opposition to imperialist domination and at the same time in opposition to the savage neoliberal policies that will never achieve social consensus. And we can see it here in Europe, actually. Look at Greece, look at Spain. People are not happy with the austerity measures. But how can we achieve that? We need to reconnect with the development project of the 60s and 70s. And despite its shortcomings and failings, I think that the vision was about a vision of liberating the Algerian economy, building a strong one, diversifying the resources, making the industrialization at the heart of your economy. And the current economy is just a rent-based bazaar import economy, and that's not sustainable. So how can we achieve that genuine democratic change? Of course, there is a crying emergency for an authentic democratic opposition to revive itself and try to politicize the demands of the Algerian people. But if people think that change will come, that democratic change will come from above, from the citadels of the regime, this is a delusion. It cannot happen. Unless we exercise pressure from underneath, organize, struggle for social justice, and get our democratic rights, the status quo will be maintained, and the interests of the profiteering caste will be preserved. So I think it's up to us as Algerians, and not just inside Algeria, but also outside Algeria, and especially the young generation, to build the alternative, to start building it, to build that movement that will have a coherent vision against any form of authoritarianism and oppression. Of course, you might say this is a utopia, but I think it is a possible utopia. It inscribes itself in a very long-term process, and I believe some people are already doing that in Algeria. For example, the Barakat movement, who started organizing and trying to mobilize the people. I believe that we need to have the determination and the sacrifice, at least to honor our forefathers who sacrificed their lives just for us to be free. I think I stop here. Thank you. I talk so much. Thank you.
Hi, so my name is Imad, and I will be brief and try to talk about two key issues, one briefer than the other, about politics and security in Algeria since the end of the 90s, since the end of the civil war in Algeria, which, as Hamza rightly put it, wasn't so civil. I think the main point I want to put across to you is that stability has been the key word in Algeria since the end of that civil war, in politics, in security, and economics. Obviously, there are many debates about what stability should mean or can mean, but I think there's been an overall trend towards stabilizing the state, which for a long time seemed as if it was drifting. And that has applied to politics, to security and economics, as I said earlier. In the political sphere, we've seen since the end of the Civil War an obvious reconfiguration of power structures within the Algerian state and within Algerian society. Within the state, you have opposition parties that once existed in the 90s, which have either disappeared or fallen in line with within the galaxy of parties that operate around the state. Another key thing I would say that has changed in Algerian politics is the relationship between citizens and politics in general. And a lot of people in Algeria tend to talk about a depoliticization. People have a sort of rejection of politics as a whole because they are concerned with day-to-day bread and butter issues, jobs, unemployment, housing. And this is where the economics comes in. Hamza was talking about earlier about Algeria's oil wealth has allowed it, since the end of the Civil War, to redistribute that wealth and create, in a way, one could say, buy social peace. Some talk about creating clientelist networks. Some people talk about fair and equitable redistribution of wealth. I'll leave that to you, for you to decide. But all in all, you do have a massive, massive focus on reinvesting the money that came about as a result of high oil prices and injecting that into society. And that happened in different sectors, mainly housing, and also in sort of creating, for example, state-related jobs, etc., etc. That political situation, that status quo, which came about following the Civil War, was really put to the test in recent times, as Hamza was talking about, and I won't go into the detail, with the emergence of the Arab Spring. I think Algeria found itself in a very complicated situation regionally, and I think both internally and externally, Algeria's regime really made sure to emphasize that point of being a beacon of stability, both domestically and abroad. Sort of the Algerian exception, as Hamza was talking about. And that exception, which moves me to the second part of what I wanted to talk about, really comes about from a stabilization of security. Algeria's main problem throughout the 90s was security and its role, its regional role, but also its international role. The state was very much isolated in the international community, and it was also, in some sense, isolated because it was seen as, you know, an exporter of instability, much like Libya is now to others. It was seen as an exporter of instability to other parts of the Maghreb. And that stability that Algeria achieved in the security sector was not an easy one to bring about, given the multiplicity of groups that were operating, jihadi groups that were operating in Algeria, most of which fragmented, decomposed, or moved on to different areas. A lot of people talk about, you know, Algeria's jihadi groups moving down to Mali, for example, and rebranding themselves as Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. And so Algeria now finds itself in an even more complex, I would say, regional climate, because it is surrounded by hubs of instability. The north of Mali is an example, I'm saying the north of Mali because it probably is the one that's in the headlines, but one can really talk about an unstable region in the whole of the Sahel, a fragile region in different areas. That includes potential new hotspots like Niger, and Chad. It's also, it has at its eastern border Libya, which is a major source of concern for the Algerian state at the moment. And for the domestic stability of Algeria, Libya is seen as a key threat because there's a fluidity of movement between terrorist groups through the borders. There's also a fluidity of movement of arms. There's a fluidity of movement of the smuggling and drugs trade. And all of these are seen as potential destabilizing factors for the Algerian state. Looking forward, looking ahead, and again, I'm trying to keep it brief so that there's more room for discussion in the question and answer session. As I said, the logic which has prevailed mainly in the political sphere in Algeria since the end of the Civil War has been one of looking towards stability, and in different ways that one can define stability. And much like in Tunisia, I'll conclude probably with this remark, much like in Tunisia, the key word of most of the movements against, you know, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali were dégage. In Algeria, one could say it is more partage, which means share, and dégage means go away. Partage instead of dégage, I think, best summarizes the mindset that has come to prevail both within society, but also within the galaxy of parties, political parties, institutions, agencies that revolve around the state. So I'm happy to answer questions in the question and answer session. So yeah, thanks for your attention.
Hi, thank you all very much for coming, and thanks to Akal and to the Mosaic Rooms and Alia for the great exhibition and for the invitation to be here. My name is James McDougall, I teach at Oxford. I'm not Algerian, but I'm very interested in Algeria, and I have lots to learn about Algeria from Algerians, so I hope that you will all have interesting things to say that I can take away for my own work. I'm writing a history of Algeria, and at least I'm trying to do that when I get time in between all the, you know, other stuff I have to do in my life, like look after my daughter and teach students and get sleep and that kind of thing. So what I want to say is, since my colleagues have talked about politics and security and the economy and the Arab Spring and the regional context, I want to say something more specifically about in terms of the perspectives that we can have on the work that's being shown here at the moment about culture, cultural production, and the relationship between culture and society and the state in Algeria over the slightly longer term. There's been, I think, and people who've written about Algerian cultural history often remark on this, an extraordinary productivity of culture of all kinds in Algeria, among Algerians, from Algerians in Algeria and abroad. And this is a major and often overlooked factor in the country's history, it seems to me, right through the 20th century. A remarkable productivity, a remarkable richness of Algerian cultural producers and production in all kinds of domains, in graphic art, in literature, in theatre, in music, and film. And this has often occurred, and perhaps this is why it hasn't been talked about quite as much as it might have been, especially by historians and political scientists looking at Algeria and concerned with the kinds of more immediate issues that have been talked about so far this evening. It hasn't been talked about that much, perhaps because it's often occurred in a kind of realm that has actually been quite separate from the political, from politics and from the state. In fact, it's often occurred and it's often been its most productive when it's had very little reference to the state, either the colonial state in the first half of the 19th century or the independent Algerian state since independence. And it's had very little to do also very often with official culture, with official cultural policy, with official cultural politics, and with the politics of culture, which have also been very important, and about which I've written a lot, perhaps mistakenly, because they turn out not to be all that interesting, perhaps, relative to all your stuff. And those kinds of things, the politics of culture, cultural politics, the way that culture has become important in Algerian politics as a way of articulating political dispute, a way of articulating political identities, as a way of arguing for sectional interest both within the regime and between the regime and society, particularly in the earlier part of the post-independence period, has been written about a great deal. So people have talked, of course, in great length, and certainly within Algeria, much has been written about the cultural impoverishment of the colonial period, the way in which Algerians had to struggle to get educated, to produce culture of any kind during the colonial period. A lot has been written about the limitations placed on the cultural field, or the limitations placed on cultural freedom of expression under the single party states from independence through to the late 1980s, particularly important, of course, for the Berberist strand of Algerian identity politics and for people talking about Kabyle culture in the 1970s and 1980s, as it expressed itself as a kind of insurgent form of Algerian identity politics articulated against an apparently monolithic state doctrine about national identity. Much has been written quite rightly about the targeting of culture and of cultural producers during the 1990s. We need to run through the list of prominent Algerian cultural producers, novelists, theatre directors and others who were assassinated during the 1990s. And of course, all of this is clearly very important. The language question has, of course, been very important to Algerian culture, but also to Algerian education, to Algerian opportunities for Algerians of different origins, different parts of the country, different social strata. To get on in life, to express themselves, and so on. There have been important debates about education and the language question and the cultural politics of that, particularly in the 1970s, and that, of course, is particularly important. There was a cultural revolution, of course, you'll tend to forget that, but there was an official cultural revolution in the 1970s, articulated by the Ministry of Religious Affairs, the Ministry of Culture, the Ministry of Education. Of course, the contestatory politics articulated around cultural identity as a vehicle or as an idiom for expressing different visions of Algerian society and Algerian politics that ended up, of course, by tearing the country apart quite significantly in the 1980s and 1990s. But if we turn aside from politics for a bit, if we change our level of analysis, as I think some historians of Algeria and indeed of the Arab world more generally are beginning to do, and look, as it were, just at cultural production, what we begin to be able to see is a remarkable capacity within Algerian culture over the long span of Algerian history, ever since the late 19th century, ever since the 1870s, 1880s, when Algerian society begins to recover socially, demographically, from the 40 years war of conquest imposed on Algeria by the French. We see a remarkable durability, a remarkable resilience, and a remarkable capacity of Algerians to produce an extraordinary and flourishing amount of amazingly diverse cultural forms, which is a really important dimension of Algerian history that it seems to me has been overlooked, and which tells us actually something quite important about longer-term structural truths about Algerian society that have often been overlooked in our tendency to focus on the political and on the turmoil of the political story in Algeria over the course of the 20th century. So just very briefly to kind of bring this point into focus with a series of examples. Let's think about space, since the exhibition is called Intervening Space, and about the way in which one could, throughout the 20th century, imagine encountering different forms of culture in a number of different places within Algeria. If, say, before World War I, if 100 years ago today you had found yourself on the Place du Gouvernement, today Sahed Shuhada, in downtown Algiers, you would have found yourself surrounded by little colonial-era cafes, many of which were run by, some owned and operated by Algerians, in which you might have come across people referred to locally as Mtournis, and that term at that time did not mean what it means now. It meant Europeans who liked Arab music. And you might have wandered into a cafe and you might have seen a bunch of Italians and Frenchmen and Maltese and Spaniards sitting around dressed in Algerian dress and listening to Nuba, listening to Arab Andalusi classical music played by Algerians in public space. You might have been able to sit down and talk, if you crossed the square, to the Djemaa Jdid, to the what the French call the Mosquée de Pêcherie, the mosque on the far side of the square, behind the statue of the Duc d'Orléans, which at that time was, of course, there. You would have been able to talk to a remarkable group of Algerian intellectuals, men fully immersed, men, of course, at that point, fully immersed in classical Islamic scholarship, fully rooted in classical Arabic and Islamic literary and religious and spiritual tradition, and also fully engaged in what was increasingly for them a very assertive dialogue sometimes with the means of the governance of Islam within the French colonial state, for which they sometimes worked, but to whom they were certainly not simply stooges and puppets. You might have met a guy called Muhammad ibn Zakri, Hunt Araf ibn Zakri, Aviskrian, from Aviskrian in Kabylia, who, before the First World War, was already writing remarkable tracts about the need for religious reform, religious change in Algeria, for greater literary revival in Algeria. You'd have met people talking about ideas that they were reading in journals and newspapers imported into Algeria from the Middle East, about ideas circulating in Egypt and Lebanon and elsewhere. And that would have been a remarkably flourishing cultural scene in a very small space within colonial Algeria that you would not know existed if you read much of the historiography that's been written about Algeria since that period. A few years later, after the First World War, imagine that you find yourself back in that space in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, and you would see the extraordinary changes taking place around you, and, of course, the origins of Algerian mass politics and of the national movement. But you would also, again, be immersed in an extraordinary polyvocal, plural, productive cultural sphere. You might go down the street a little bit to the Rue de la Marine, to the Great Mosque, to Cem-i Kabir, and there you might hear a remarkable young man named Mahyeddin Beshtarzi with a beautiful tenor voice reading the Quran. He would later be the leader of one of Algeria's first major theatrical troupes in Trebia, which in the 1920s and 30s tours around the countryside, bringing theatre to the Algerian people in rural areas. You might go up the hill from the Place du Gouvernement, and you might go visit the Madrasa de Shabib al-Islamiyah, the school for Islamic youth, where you would have been able to meet the great Algerian poet Muhammad Ali del Khalifa, teaching Arabic, alongside other people teaching French. You might have gone back down the hill and hung out in some of the slightly seedier bars towards the Admiralty, where you would have been able to hear people like Haji Muhammad Lanka inventing Sha'abi, which, of course, now the whole world is familiar with, thanks to El Gusto, but which, of course, had already been developing in Algeria since the 1890s. At the same time, again, in the 1920s, 1930s, imagine that you transport yourself to Constantine, and you walk up to the Lycée next to the French barracks in the top corner of the old city, and you might meet Ahmed Reda Khoukhou, the great Algerian short story writer and novelist who had been murdered by the French paratroopers during the War of Independence, but who in the 30s and 40s was at the height of his literary productivity. If you took the train to Tlemcen, you might be able to go and sit and listen to the great Jog, the orchestra of Sheikh Larbi bin Sari, playing the full repertoire of Arabic Andalusian music with a beautiful Tlemcenian accent, which was very carefully preserved and very carefully handed down from generation to generation. Even in the middle of the war in the 1950s, a few years later, imagine that you're travelling through some of these spaces, and you might hear Sheikh Hermiti on the radio. Sheikh Hermiti was the beginning of her career at that point, but she was frequently on the radio. She was frequently on the radio despite the fact that the French monitored her broadcasts because they thought she was subversive. Muhammad Di Mulut Faraun, Malik Haddad, Ketib Yassin, of course, were all at the heights of their careers. So what does that tell us, a kind of quick portrait of a multiple, plural, flourishing Algerian cultural sphere that has generally dropped out of our vision of what Algeria was like in this period? Now, I don't want to suggest that the colonial period was some kind of, to kind of rehabilitate the colonial period as some kind of wonderful world of cosmopolitan pluralism and harmony where Algerians could kind of get on and make culture just as they pleased, because, of course, it was not anything like that. But the way in which culture became politicized after independence, I think, has tended to make the longer-term persistence, perseverance, durability, and productivity of Algerian culture very difficult to perceive. And one of the things that's actually quite wonderful about much of the Algerian cultural production in recent years is that we've now, I think, been able to move beyond that in such a way that not only is Algerian culture now a major global export, Algeria doesn't just give the world oil and gas and distinguished diplomats like Lakhdar Brahimi. It also, you know, has given the world an enormous number of extraordinary cultural phenomena. And the fact that has been, in fact, a constant feature of Algerian history which has tended to be occluded by the focus on the political. Tells us something quite important to think about Algerian society more generally and its relation to the state, which is to say that even though during the colonial period, during the years of the single party regime, during the years of the catastrophe in the 1990s, and the years of an exceedingly difficult, not yet in any sense visible transition since then, there are fundamental mechanisms at work in Algerian society that enable Algeria, or have always, at least since, at least in my view, since the mid 19th century, enabled Algerian society to express itself and to organise itself, often in a way that has very little relation to the state. Not against the state, not through the state, not with the state, but as it were, without reference to the state. Now, that's not to say that Algerians don't care about politics, and certainly not to say that they don't care about what the state does and what it is capable of doing to them, as indeed was very visible during the War of Independence and again in the 1990s. But it's to point to something really important that's often been ignored, I think, in histories of Algeria, which is the extraordinary durability and the persistence of quite deep structural forms of resilience in Algerian society, which have survived everything that 19th and 20th century history has thrown at Algeria in terms of political history, and in terms of violence, and in terms of economic impoverishment, and in terms of all the other things we might talk about on those levels. And that shows us something quite important about the ways in which Algerians have continued to be and express themselves in all kinds of ways, completely separate from the domain of the political. I did try to be brief, but as usual, I didn't quite work.